On behalf of the SIPC Institute for the Mathematical Sciences, I would like to thank the director, Ms. Kazoo. I would like to welcome you to the first public lecture of our workshop, Numeracy and Beyond, which Klaus has been organizing. Before turning the podium back to Klaus to introduce the speaker, I'd like to give you a brief introduction to the Institute. Of course, you're familiar with it. PIMS was founded in 1996. It's a collaboration of the five largest universities in Western Canada, University of Alberta, University of Calgary, Simon Fraser University, University of Columbia, University of Victoria, and also, more recently, University of Washington, Seattle is also
involved. Which is also part of Canada.
As far as we're concerned, yes.
It's a southern peninsula.
Yeah, and also, PIMS operates the Banff International Research Station in Banff, Alberta, where second workshop on numeracy will be held in 2004. The mandate of PIMS is threefold. It's research, industrial outreach, and education. And I urge you to explore the PIMS website to learn more about some of the other education programs at PIMS. We're very proud of our education program at PIMS. We're very proud of the job that Klaus has been doing to further it, because in the words of Robert Louis Stevenson, we should not judge each day by the harvest we reap, by the seeds we plant.
Sandy is really a physicist by training. No mathematician could have kept it this short. I will try to do my best, though, to imitate him. And therefore, I think I'll look for the speaker. Yes, he's over there. And introduce to you Bernie Madison from Arkansas.
It says
University of Arkansas. Yes, I know. It says right up there, from the University of Arkansas, and it also works for the National Council on Education and the Disciplines, and this, I don't know, the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, I don't know.
That's part of the Woodrow Wilson.
And is that on there too?
No.
Okay, well anyway, Bernie will give us a talk, and he's really basically Mr. QLUSA. He's the one who's done most of the work on this quantitative literacy problem in the United States. And here he is to tell us of his experience.
I disavow that title. I have been working for the last few years at the Woodrow Wilson Foundation with the National Council on Education and the Disciplines, which Bob Orrell created after he left the College Board. The work has been sponsored by the Carnegie Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trust. I was in Washington one of those years working for the Mathematical Association of America, and I still work for the Mathematical Association of America in directing teacher education projects and assessment projects. So. All it does is keep me traveling a lot. So that's not always pleasant, but it's very pleasant to come to Vancouver. PIMS should be. This is a wonderful city. I've been here once before and I enjoyed it very much. And it's one of the marvelous settings of the world for a university, as far as I'm concerned. The other one is in Beirut, I think, where you have the mountains in the background and the sea coast out there. And so, is it dying? Is that better? Is that better?
Are you coming through?
Yeah, it's coming through, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try to talk into this one then. I will probably say some things that will disagree with some of the things you've heard today, these are just a lot of this is just thoughts from a fellow who's a first generation college student off of a farm in rural Kentucky. I am no expert in learning theory, nor am I an expert in how we deal with the problem of educating for cross-cutting competencies, which I think is the real challenge that's facing higher education over the next several years. In the States, we'll probably also be subjected to, our students will also have to take tests. That's coming for higher education. And so K through 12 is going through it now, and we will go through it later. I can almost guarantee you that. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here actually to talk about, my title is Numeracy and Democracy, and that's some of the things that were said this morning by the panel are things that I will repeat, but I'll try to cast them in a slightly different. Is that better?
Ooh,
that's lots better. Okay, now. Democratic societies depend on citizens to make informed decisions across a multitude of contexts, political, economic, and environmental. And democracy, combined with individualism, places double importance on reasoned decisions about economic security and personal health and happiness. And capitalism and economic choices add mountains of possibilities for challenging problems and opportunities. Some of these issues confronting citizens in democracies are as old as the democracies themselves, but a very, very many of them are distinctly modern, as modern as the last decade. And most newer issues are quantitative ones, created by amassing and analyzing data by computers. Quantitative measures, rates of change, and rates of change have intruded most phases of our lives, even political satire, and I'm going to read those for you because it illustrates the number. Even political satire, as demonstrated by this radical British cartoon, the idea of using numbers in casting aspersions in a cartoon is something that I don't know if you would have seen in years past. And they've also intruded into the comic strips where there's a message being sent by the boss, I guess. And it's a message that is not unusual because it's a message that many people can't compute the percentage of 2 out of 5. Because these democracies depend on informed citizens, and an effective educational system is essential. Literacy and literacy rates are critical in assessing health of democracies. In the early 20th century, my own democracy, the U.S., moved toward universal secondary education, raising questions about secondary education's role for employment, for engaged citizenship, and for democratic well-being. Now, a century later, the U.S. and other democracies are moving toward universal post-secondary education, raising those same questions about higher education. The reason is clear. Society has become more complex. Literacy has become more sophisticated. Our age is dominated by computers and data and not factory assembly lines as before. The old three R's, and I don't know if you use the three R's in Canada and Europe, but the old three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, we couldn't spell either, are no longer sufficient for today's world. The third R, in particular, is worlds apart from itself. Scarcely any issue facing society today can be resolved without recourse to sophisticated quantitative analysis and argumentation. It's this uniquely modern blend of arithmetic with complex reasoning that we call quantitative literacy or numeracy. As Randy Richardson and Bill McCollum have observed, the traditional meaning of literate, able to read and write, has left the third R on its own, a separation that's reflected in our traditional curriculum. Reading and writing are taught together, and mathematics is taught as a separate course, a separate subject. But the list of things that a literate person must now read in everyday life contains charts and diagrams and tables and algorithms. If you want to look at a couple from the New York Times here, this is a graphic that I've asked statisticians if they ever put this kind of graphic in their statistics courses. You've seen bar graphs and everything, but the New York Times now uses these circle graphs, and they and It's not, as far as I know, taught in any school, but it's the areas of the circles are indicative of the size of the quantity. This one is very interesting because it's entitled The Rise in Spending. But if you look at that, you don't really see a rise. You do finally see a rise over at the right-hand end. But what it really is a graph of the second derivative. It's a graph showing the rates of inflation, the rates of increase in the cost of healthcare from a year-to-year basis. So what you're looking at here is the graph of the second derivative, and it's called a rise in spending. And my wager is that not very many people recognize that. This one is incredible with the mountains of information that were in there. Every one of those lines and circles and things, the width and, of these has a meaning in the flow of oil in and out of the U.S. These graphics are illustrative of what is being printed in the New York Times, which supposedly is being written at the level of high school. Now, USA Today is supposedly written at the level of the eighth grade, I'm not sure that either is written for people. The people at those grades can read them. Now, here's basically my thesis for the day, and it's taken from the forthcoming book on achieving quantitative literacy. As reading and writing are part of primary school through college and beyond, so must be quantitative literacy. Although basic elements of reading and writing are in elementary school curriculum, continued growth in both is universally recognized as an essential part of college education. So it is with QL. Although most of the mathematical tools required for QL are taught in school, continued reflective experience with data throughout college deepens students' capacity to use these tools for productive lives and responsible citizenship. Now, this position underlies a lot of the work that we've done at the National Council on Education and the Disciplines, where they're actually looking at four literacies. They're looking at quantitative literacy, historical literacy, communicative literacy, and scientific literacy. The one that is most far advanced on that is the quantitative literacy. My aim this afternoon for you is to outline some circumstances surrounding numeracy in the U.S. Some are cultural, some are historical, and some are alarming, at least to me. These circumstances are likely similar to those in Canada and other Western democracies, but certain features of the U.S. exaggerate these things. I apologize for this self-centered view, but which stems mainly from my ignorance about your country and others, but hopefully you will see some of the things, you will recognize some of the things in your own countries. Please note that I've said almost nothing about the vocational requirements for QL, and that will continue to be the case. My focus is on life outside the workplace, although some of these issues do relate to work. Needless to say, the workplace demands for QL are enormous and add urgency to the needs for outside the workplace. Much of what I say today is based on three publications, which I will undoubtedly refer to as QL3 and QL4, and I wanted to give you the key. The QL1 was published by the College Board in 1997, QL2 was published by NCED in 2001, and QL4 was published just a month ago, and QL3 is the one that I referred to that is forthcoming. Now, I heard some discussion this morning about the meaning of quantitative literacy or numeracy. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes on that to let you know at least what there's some possibilities. Literacy itself has two meanings in usage. To say that a person is literate can mean that the person is minimally able to read and write. On the other hand, literati means the educated class, the intelligentsia. Numeracy and QL exhibit some form of this bifurcated usage. My own view of literacy is in quantitative literacy is somewhere between the two usages. Closer maybe to the IALS, the International Adult Literacy Studies, use of literacy as the ability to understand and employ printed information in daily activities at home, at work, and in the community. It's a very practical meaning, able to cope with everyday life. Historian Lawrence Crimmins has actually made a distinction between levels of literacy. Inert literacy, which is a level of verbal and numerate skills required to comprehend instructions, perform routine procedures, and complete tasks in a routine manner. But liberating literacy is command of both the enabling skills needed to search out information and the power of mind necessary to critique it, reflect upon it, and apply it in making decisions. Now certainly we should achieve, hopefully achieve, inert QL, but we should aim for liberating QL. Quantitative literacy or numeracy have several relatives, and we've mentioned those. Among those are mathematical literacy, document literacy, symbol literacy, statistical literacy, and financial literacy. There are different meanings. There are difference in meanings of these, but I agree with Mogens Nis of Denmark, who wrote that most people who write about QL or one of its relatives are speaking of roughly the same animal. The broad definition of Gina Collada of the New York Times, that QL means knowing how to reason and to think, leads to literacy being the four R's, reasoning being the fourth. QL, numeracy, and all of the relatives are thus included. Eva Yablanka and others have observed that the meaning of QL, or mathematical literacy, is tied to social practice as well as economic and political culture. Thus, my view of QL in the context of the QL is in the context of the U.S. culture. As Yablanka notes, different conceptions of mathematical literacy are related to how the relationship between mathematics, the surrounding culture, and the curriculum is conceived. To a very large extent, mathematics and mathematics education are not culture-bound or value-driven, drawing our first distinction between what I think of mathematics and what I think of quantitative literacy. Financial literacy has been in our news most recently, no doubt prompted by the accounting scandals and increased bankruptcies in the U.S. In fact, Alan Greenspan last March was making some statements about the need for improved math education because people who don't know how to do mathematics are vulnerable. More recently, there were reports in our press that financial illiteracy is common. And financial illiteracy, interestingly enough, was equated to bankruptcies. So the increase in bankruptcies was seemingly caused by financial illiteracy. If you look at my favorite cartoon, financial illiteracy occurs in the comic strips in a couple of different ways. This one indicates how one comic character gets distraught by changing dimes and quarters to other things. And then, of course, there's this one where the student is motivated by putting dollar signs in front of all of the numbers because then they can work with them much more easily. As I was preparing for this talk, I noticed that in two things I had written, I had used two different definitions myself of quantitative literacy. I once defined it to be the ability to understand and use quantitative measures and inferences that allow one to function as a responsible citizen, a productive worker, and a discerning consumer. That was in an article in the Notices of the AMS. I also, in QL4, something I read, QL is the ability to understand and use numbers and data in everyday life. These are roughly equivalent. Deb Hughes-Hallett introduces a sort of new twist on this. It's the ability to identify, understand, and use quantitative arguments in everyday context. That's what I said. But then she says, QL describes a habit of mind rather than a set of topics or lists of skills. And Then Lynn Steen has used this, QL is the capacity to deal with quantitative aspects of life. The Jan de Lange of the Netherlands used this definition: numeracy is the ability to handle numbers and data correctly and to evaluate statements regarding problems and situations that invite mental processing and estimating. Bob Orrell, in an email to me, made it clear to me that I think literacy belongs in this title. Now, numeracy may be shorthand for numerical literacy, and if that's okay. But Bob pointed out to me that in an email that QL relates to a cultural field where language and quantitative constructs merge and are no longer one or the other. And I find that language intrudes quite a lot in the in issues about QL. This combination of language and number underlays a study of statistical literacy by Milo Shield at Augsburg College in Minnesota, financed by the Keck Foundation. At issue is the understanding of statements about statistical concepts. For example, if the rate of participation in a certain government program increases from 20% to 60%, is this an increase of 40% or an increase of 200%? Different people will use it in different ways, and it's a matter of language. It's that is the issue there. You have to be more precise for the mathematician to get the 200%. This is the kind of statement that Milo is putting out in front of people and asking him, what does this mean? I mean, is this 200% or 40%? Longer definitions, operational definitions of QL have been given by the Cockcroft Report, the U.S. National Adult Literacy Survey, the International Life Skills Survey, and PISA, which has already been mentioned here. Here is the one from NALS. I won't read it for you. Let me make it clear that I don't think that QL is mathematics. QL is neither mathematics nor statistics, nor is it watered down mathematics. It's a way of thinking that enhances tools from mathematics and statistics to describe and understand everyday occurrences. One major difference between quantitative literacy and mathematics is that quantitative literacy is richly contextual, while mathematics students are often asked to rise above context. As you've heard so eloquently stated by my predecessors of today, in today's conferences, the power of mathematics is often in its abstractness and its generality. The theory is that students will be able to use the mathematics in various contexts. But as we know, this is enormously difficult. The arts of application and exposition of mathematics are not easily learned. So contextual use of mathematics in quantitative literacy requires educational attention. Too often, I believe, QL ideas in education are expressed in insiders' mathematical-oriented terms. And very little mathematics is understood in these terms out in the general public. Despite the use of QL as a euphemism for statistics in the U.S. K-12 curriculum, which stems from an NSF-funded NCTM and American Statistical Association work in the 90s, QL is not the same as statistics. Unlike statistics, which is principally about uncertainty, numeracy is often about the logic of certainty. Now, QL has many faces and multiple aspects, and a precise definition is of intellectual interest, but not necessary, I believe, for the education for QL. However, the multiple meanings attached to QL could be an obstacle in achieving support for QL education. The real divide is the divide between over meanings of literate, one being minimally competent and the other being a sophisticate. Numeracy, I believe, does matter for the schools and the colleges, And as Gina Collada noted, it is all but absent from our curricula today. An article I wrote about QL a couple of years ago was titled QL is Everybody's Orphan. And basically what my message was that every U.S. citizen needs a high level of quantitative literacy. And no part of our educational system claims quantitative literacy as its responsibility. Thus the title, Everybody's Orphan. As a now an essential part of literacy, responsibility for QL education, I believe, falls to all disciplines, but most heavily on mathematics and statistics. Because of this, the privileged place of mathematics in our curricula, in the K through 16 curriculum, the heaviest responsibility for QL is going to fall on mathematics for quite some time. I will come back to mathematics and QL, but now to my central point. I want to talk about the exaggerations of the need for numeracy in the U.S. culture. Numbers have immeasurably altered the character of American society, writes Pat Cohen in the concluding pages of her book, A Calculating People. Cohen continues, "Our modern reliance on numbers and quantification was born and nurtured in the scientific and commercial worlds of the 17th century and grew in scope in the early 19th century under the twin impacts of Republican ideology and economic development. In these two decades since Cohen's 1982 book, reliance on numbers and quantification has increased well beyond what could have been imagined, and no end is in sight. Number has an interesting and colorful history in America and in the world, mixed with religion, mysticism, and magic, deception, and cryptology. Numbers are both trusted for ensuring truth and honesty and suspected as in underwriting deceit. The association of lies with statistics carried on by the title of Joel Best's 2001 book, Damn Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists, goes back at least to the 19th century British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli. Reputed characterization of three kinds of lies in political life, lies, damn lies, and statistics. Deceit is not limited to using statistics. Consider this argument from a syndicated news article written by Jerry Taylor of the Cato Institute. The argument in the U.S. was whether it was worth it or not to change the building of the SUVs and the pickup trucks and things like that to increase the gas mileage from 18.1 to 26.7 miles per gallon. The cost was arrived at $1,466 per vehicle. Okay, so the argument rages, is that worth it or not? Well, Taylor has a particular take on this. What he claimed in that article, it would take the typical driver 14 years to save this on gasoline. You should be able to check that. And if you use the price of gasoline at $1.40 a gallon in the U.S. when this was written, and it's about that now, it depends on where you are, and 10,000 miles a year, that's not even close. It's about 5.6 years. Now, he also asserted that $1,466 in a checking account yielding 5% per annum would be a better investment. And it is if you're willing to wait 39 years. The first one is a simple intersection of two linear lines. And the second one involves an exponential function that you'll need to be able to handle. But not very many people are able to do this. The one way to spot errors in quantitative conclusions like this is sensitivity to reasonableness of the answer. Because when you read this and you have some sense of how to do this and you can estimate it, you can see whether the person is in the ballpark or not, and you may not have to do it. Now, my friend Calvin has a different way of deciding what their answer is reasonable. Because This is one way of deciding if the answer is reasonable, but there are actually better ways of estimating whether it is true or not. From the beginnings in the late 17th century, number has always been a way to it. We attempt to exercise control over nature, over risk, and over life itself. Prior to the 17th century in Europe, the order of the cosmos, as Tony referred to this morning, was dominated by the classical Aristotelian systems of classification and religion. Quantification emerged in the 17th century as an alternate way to make sense out of the world. England was becoming a commercial capital, and numbers were needed to describe the economy. Arabic numerals had finally been adopted, and the first books on arithmetic had appeared. Education in arithmetic was beginning, but was, according to the historians, an arcane subject cut into small bits, not easy to learn. Sound familiar? America as a commercial, arithmetic as a commercial subject was disconnected from formal mathematics. Sound familiar? Sir William Petty in 1690 coined the phrase political arithmetic to mean an accounting of the total resources of a country for the purpose of formulating policy. Petty was a proponent of the belief that anything described in numerical terms was objective and accurate, however the numbers were arrived at. Let's take a note of those three things. Anything described in commercial numerical terms was believed by some to be objective and accurate. Education in arithmetic was an arcane subject cut into small bits, not easy to learn. And arithmetic as a commercial subject was disconnected from formal mathematics. Most of that still true to some extent in the 21st century, because it depends on who you talk to. Now, I'm always amused by people who try to make arguments using numbers. I won't ask you to read this entire letter to the editor, but the title of it was "Math Proves a Point." Now, down at the bottom, it concludes an argument about a social issue. About whether the most Catholic priests are homosexual or pedophiliacs. I don't know why that is the casting of the problem. But they do some mathematics in there, not related to the real issue at all, but then to conclude that it does prove the point because the mathematics they do is correct. And the mathematics is given credit for achieving this argument. There's another one, and in the States, the reparations for people who have been enslaved, whose ancestors have been enslaved, has been an argument that has raged. This is a person who is trying to convince her daughter or his daughter that because a great 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 grandfather imported slaves, that there's no worry because there's too many people between that great 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 grandmother and her to matter. And they decide that there's 18 generations there. I believe it's 18 generations, 19 generations. And they say, okay, there's two to the 19th people between them. Well, that's not even close. I mean, there could be as few as 19 people between them. They're using some model of population growth in the wrong direction. But the mathematics justifies the position there. Now, in 17th century colonial America, numbering was a tool for advertising settlements and for controlling the number of plants of tobacco in Virginia in order to control the price. And that, no doubt, was the first instance of agricultural stabilization and conservation in American history. By the 18th century, colonial leaders such as Jefferson and Franklin and Washington were promoting arithmetic and mathematics in support of the new experiment in democracy. The decline of the ideas of fatalism, unpredictability, and uncertainty gave way to mathematical sense as a way of influencing life and death outcomes. Mortality rates did indicate that inoculations did help, and climate did help or did affect diseases. So numbers begin to be as valuable. Sometimes, though, as an escape from the emotional trauma of disease and pestilence. Examples today abound. Look at the numbers and reports of earthquakes, of floods, terrorist attacks, fires, SARS, not to mention something that's a sore subject up here, AIDS, and etc. Number can both provide this escape from reality and make the case for heightened awareness over the extent of tragedies or threats. U.S. culture from its earliest days has shown an inclination toward quantification. The title of Pat Cohen's book, Calculating People, stems from an observation about the American culture made by a European visitor in the 1830s. The demands of a democracy, an expansive and diverse country, and persistent and aggressive economic development have fed this inclination to its enormity of today. The reasons why the U.S. culture feeds the QL demands of democracy are many. First and fundamentally is the constitutional mandate that we have for a census. Numbering of people, an event mandated by our Constitution, has expanded to Petty's political arithmetic and has given rise to what people refer to as the politics of numbers that has generated a considerable literature about the role of numbers in social and political thinking. As an example, William Alonzo and Paul Starr edited a volume recently of 14 essays on the 1980 U.S. Census with five parts: politics of economic measurement, politics of population measurement, statistics and democratic politics, statistics and American federalism, and the new political economy of statistics. This scholarship and articles like Mary Poovey's "Can Numbers Ensure Honesty? Unreasonable Expectations and the U.S. Accounting Scandal" provide an intellectual background and explain some issues and raise some questions about the practical use of numbers. The free market systems and a minimally regulated labor markets. Over the past 75 years, the U.S. has moved toward and then away from a system that provides broad support for all of its citizens. There are minimal earnings for unemployed and underemployed in the U.S., much less than in some other Western democracies. Tony Carnevale of ETS has observed that this lack of support may cause many to drop out of the political system and withdraw from community life, becoming failures as good neighbors and good citizens. He goes on to state that with no substantial safety nets, individuals, not governments or employers, pay the price for underinvestment of obsolescence in human capital. This is part of the argument that Carnevale makes to point out that the U.S. is being divided into haves and have-nots. Actually, in his word, math haves and math have-nots. This is a prelude to his warning that the wall of ignorance between those who are mathematically and scientifically literate and those who are not can threaten democratic cultures. Democratic accountability. Public officials in the U.S. have much more power than ordinary citizens. Yet ordinary citizens are supposed to be able to control the public officials by the ballot box. One would believe that in a representative democracy that has an inherent safeguard against the kind of divisions that we now see in U.S. society. Presumably, the have-nots would use the ballot box to change government policies to give themselves more support. Surprisingly, some research studies should report that voters tend to vote based on the general health of the entire economy rather than on their own economic conditions. And many have dropped out. Voter turnouts are dismally low, and no doubt partly prompted by their ignorance on issues. Furthermore, have-nots or no-nots voters are easy prey for sophisticated political arguments and are often mired in data and quantitative arguments. Representation of diverse interests, one of the early issues in the founding fathers, minority representation as we now know it. Worry about achieving a homogeneous common good for so large a country generated position that knowing enough facts would mitigate differences of opinions. Facts would dispel the factious spirit. Authentic facts were thus held to be the essential foundation of good government. James Madison, the principal author of the U.S. Constitution, pushed for gathering more comprehensive information, being clearly on the clash between the two notions of what was the common good. Madison believed that the census revealing several classes would allow Congress to adapt legislation to reality. The 1820 census was the breakthrough, breaking the common good in constituent parts. Thus, the government accepted responsibility for fostering economic growth gathering facts that have become increasingly quantitative. The ethnic diversity of the U.S. population, our various laws protecting minorities, and affirmative action policies lay the basis for unending quantitative and statistical analysis and analyses and arguments. The very concept of a minority carries a quantitative measure. Informing political debate. Politics, in some people's minds, has become how much for how many. Major political issues that generate two opposing views often give rise to statistical and graphical depiction of those views. For example, the first George W. Bush budget was presented as a major reduction in spending from the Clinton budgets by arguing that the rate of increase had slowed. To the mathematically able, again, that is that the second derivative was negative. At least the second derivative computed from two or three discrete data points. Every change in taxes generates two very different views of the effects. Recently, the Republicans in the U.S. made arguments that the projected $308 billion deficit in this year, now estimated to be $400 billion, was not a record in spite of the fact that the dollar amount was the largest ever. In a few minutes, the Democrats are on the other side of this. So they argued that the one other deficit measured in current day dollars was larger, than this deficit as a percent of the gross domestic product was less than some previous deficit. True. What this does is to use fairly complex rates of change to confound serious issues as well as the voters. So much of the political argument debate in the U.S. centers on the state of our economy. Remember the Clinton strategist James Carville's desk sign in the 1992 campaign? It's the economy, stupid. Even September the 11th and subsequent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been analyzed as to their economic effect. U.S. citizens were urged to go out and shop as opposed to buying war bonds or conserving commodities useful in the war effort as we had done in previous wars. Economic information, along with other public information, is often concluded or couched in condensed measures and indexes, such as the computer price index, the Dow Jones index, the gross domestic product, or the wholesale price index, and many others. Few people know what these indexes mean, so they're at the mercy of the analyst and often have a bias. They have a bias to support. Confirming national identity. What counts in the U.S. is what's counted. Beginning at Jamestown in the 17th century, counting and quantifying American resources has become a way of establishing national identity. We know our highest and lowest points in all 50 states. We know our annual production of cotton by states, and we get the economic indicator indexes almost daily. The daily news is filled with numbers, the Dow average, as I mentioned, the NASDAQ, Standards and Poor's, the various commodity futures, this month's rainfall, year-to-date traffic fatalities, and the box office takes of the latest movies. In America, it is indeed what counts is what counted. Deregulation in recent years has compounded the number of complexity of choices of Americans in health care, retirement plans, banking, insurance, plane fares, credit cards, and stocks and bonds. Technology has brought many of these options to our home desktops via the internet, giving rise to day trading, instant purchasing, and floods of information that may be flawed or even designed to deceive. Other deregulation has occurred as the federal government has moved away from categorical programs toward block programs and revenue sharing, making careful counting of people a basis for revenue distribution. Census every 10 years are no longer sufficient to keep the counts accurate. Environmental protection and occupational safety. These have generated sophisticated debates and complex statistical models in the states. EPA and OSHA have become familiar and controversial acronyms in the U.S. Court battles over the health effects of air pollution, pesticides, and herbicides have been highly technical and enormously expensive. There's worry that we will not be able to find jurors who understand any part of these arguments. My own state is mired in a difficult argument over non-point source pollution, namely the phosphorus runoff from chicken litter. The issues are scientific, but the standards for regulation are usually numbers, and numbers that need to be understood. Fairly soon, urban dwellers, for reasons that will be unknown to them, will find that the phosphorus sales will be tightly controlled and that the standard fertilizer at Walmart is 10-0-10 instead of 10-10-10. The final one is the emphasis on wealth accumulation, capital gains. The QL demands on U.S. citizens in managing their savings and investments have increased dramatically in the U.S. economy that's moved from agriculture to an industry to information and finally to what Mary Poovey calls the culture of finance. The last move was in 1995 when finance, insurance, and real estate in the U.S. sector overtook the manufacturing sector in the U.S. gross domestic product. That is, we moved from an economy of production to the culture of finance. If one chooses to invest in that very American institution, the stock market, and confronts what Poovey describes as a new axis of power, the culture of finance, the stock market has evolved into an enormously complicated maze where creative accounting, partly allowed by deregulation, has masked and even fraudulently presented the values of companies. Millions are made and lost by day trading, where internet chat rooms become vehicles for stock price manipulation. Company executives get instantly wealthy with stock options that go unaccounted for on company records. Company values are manipulated by off-balance sheet partnerships and adjustment to bad debt reserves. And derivative trading is so large that money cannot change hands because there's not a currency in the world. There's not enough currency in the world. This is a point that is made by this cartoon, which gets to the, I found this one very interesting because it's got some topology in it. I found some numbers that support your strategic plan. I had to take the square root of a negative number to do it. The timeline is on the Mobius strip. Good work. They won't understand that one. Okay. The culture of finance is in stark contrast to this economy of production in that finance generates profits through investment, currency trading, and betting on whether or not commodity prices will rise or fall. How can such a culture be fair in our educational system? Let me take a minute here to look at these examples that I pointed out. This is the deficit argument. The deficit then was projected to be $304 billion, but there was a, if you change that into 1996 dollars, there are deficits in the past, it becomes $267, and there's a deficit in the past that's bigger. If you change it into a percent of the gross domestic product, it's a smaller percentage than something in the past. Now, I don't know how many of our citizens would understand that. I wager very few. Here's two views of a tax cut, the Democratic view and the Republican view, the same tax cut with two different graphs that say they're both accurate as far as I know. They're just graphing different things. That was a 92 tax cut. Now here the Democrats are on the other side. This has to do with discretionary spending and the Republicans are doing it in billions of dollars, while the Democrats now want to do it as a percentage of the gross domestic product. So one day it satisfies your means to do this, and the next day it satisfies your means not to do this. And I don't think our people really understand that. Now in the news in the U.S. has been the unreliability of mammograms for detecting breast cancer. This is the error percentage of errors, false positives from different radiologist readings. This made the news, which caused me to rephrase the false positive paradox in the terms of this particular thing. The incidence of breast cancer in women over 50 is approximately 380 in 100,000. If cancer is present, a mammogram will detect it approximately 85% of the time, 15% false negatives, that is. That's an average of those others. If the cancer is not present, the mammogram will indicate cancer approximately 7% of the time, 7% false positives. Now, I I mentioned this because Klaus wrote a piece in the one of the publications of PIMS on Am I Really Sick? Was that right, Klaus? Which he was doing this. But I gave this problem to our 21 graduating math seniors last spring. I gave it to them and I said, okay, if you get a positive reading, if a mammogram is positive, what are the odds that cancer is present? And I gave them 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 7 out of 10, 1 out of 6, 1 out of 12, and 1 out of 22. Almost all of them picked 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 7 out of 10. Almost all of them picked it. There were a few that picked the longer odds. Only one of the 21 picked the 1 out of 22, which is correct. Now, these are math majors, and three of them were on the statistics track. Now, I don't make a point that they should have known this, but they should. We should worry about why they don't. Because if they can't, then most people who get positive mammograms will not read. I want to finish up by saying a few words about what I think about mathematics and about what I think is in store. Winston Churchill observed that first we shape our buildings and then they shape us. Our higher education system, a freewheeling entrepreneurial climate and favorable attitudes toward accumulating wealth have combined to permeate American society with technologies based largely on computers and flooded citizens with data and numbers. In turn, as with Churchill's buildings, number quantification, data, and analyses shape American culture and are more powerful forces than we realize. The shaping will only increase the demands for QL. Now, how is one to educate for this environment? Now, various international education studies have shown the U.S. to be at best in the middle in sometimes educational attainment. We have an educational system that at the same time produces the world's best scientists and engineers, or at least some of the world's best scientists and engineers, and one that has a general education results that is near the bottom. Now, a couple of those reports were national reports, A Nation at Risk and Before It's Too Late. This one is one that didn't receive much attention in the U.S. press. I won't go into it. It's an International Adult Literacy Survey where the U.S. comes out near the end here. I'm just reporting what they said. This is their graph. The UK is a bit above us, and Canada is in the middle there. The underachievement rate, the U.S. Leads the world, and that's the percentage performing below the literacy level of 3, which on the document scale. So this is not good news. I don't know if it's accurate or not. I think you have to look at lots of things to decide whether this. The U.S. has an interesting educational system. It's fairly unique in the world in the sense that we don't have any central education authority in K through 12, even in this, not even sometimes in the states. Often that's local control. Our higher education system operates more or less as 3,000 independent contractors. Our K through 12 mathematics is controlled fairly reasonably, or at least there is a description of in the NCTM standards, the 2000 version, which were a revision of the 1989 first edition. But the higher education holds a lot of power in the U.S. It influences a lot of what goes on in colleges and in high schools. Testing, mandated testing, some of it large scale, some of it high stakes, is also going to have a, a, put pressure on schools. And then, so these are two forces that are there, and they may be sending very different messages. Because the higher education message is not coherent at all, because it's not being, there is no unity there. But what have we done? If you look at the high school enrollments as a percentage of the 14 to 17 age cohort, they started out in 1900 at about 10% of that cohort, and they reached 90% in, they reached 70% in 1940, and then they've gone up to 90%, and they've stayed there. Our higher education enrollment as a percentage of the 18 to 24 cohort has increased about 10% in each decade starting in about 1950. People started going to college in large numbers. In fact, if you look at the total enrollments in high school in the U.S. in the blue line from 1990 to 2000 and projected beyond that, and the college enrollments in 1990, the number of people enrolled in higher education surpassed the number of people enrolled in high school. So the population going to college in the U.S. has changed dramatically over the last several years. Now, I'm always surprised at is that when you look at the creation of majors in higher education in the U.S., really a result of Eliot's reformation of the Harvard curriculum in the early 20th century, and the general education courses were a reaction to that. Almost all disciplines in higher education have developed general education courses. Mathematics was the lone exception. Mathematics served up the same course, the same set of courses as general education courses, basically as it served for its own majors. And in fact, if you look at the 1900 catalog, and you look at the description of the catalog of the college algebra course, the algebra course that was there, it's very, very similar to the college algebra courses taught today. The topics are the same. The methodology may be different, but we have been teaching the same course over the century, where our college population has changed dramatically. And we now have universal post-secondary education, and not all of those students are aiming for calculus. Not all of them are going to be engineers and scientists. They're going to be something else. They're going to be journalists. They're going to be teachers. And I believe we're not serving them well with our current geometry, algebra, trigonometry, calculus sequence. I think we need seriously to work on that. Let me close by noting an irony that I alluded to earlier. The very forces that now press colleges to address issues of quantitative literacy were created by colleges and universities in the first place. Changes in society that demand widespread quantitative literacy arose in large measure from innovations of college graduates seeking greater effectiveness and efficiencies in the fabric of life and work. We must now turn that creativity to coping with our own creations.
Well, that was certainly a very stimulating and interesting conversation. Thank you very much, Bernie. And thank you very much for coming out and listening and being so interested in this. I don't think there's any room for questions right now. Is there any burning questions?
Ben? Anybody want to throw rocks?
I think that he made a very convincing argument. As mathematicians, you have given a convincing argument, but there's still very little.
No. This is not a proof.
I was quite pressing though, because you're so